This is Arab Talk on KPOO 89.5 FM in San Francisco. This is Arab Talk with Jess and Jamal. I'm Jess Hanem.
And I'm Jamal Dajani.
Jamal, we're facing the sixth month of the genocide of Palestinians in Gaza, as well as the ongoing destruction and death of Palestinians in the West Bank and Jerusalem. As we're approaching the final 10 days of Ramadan and Easter Sunday in Jerusalem, the ongoing ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in Palestine continues with full force. Children are literally starving to death. The United Nations has called for a ceasefire. The ICJ has indicated that Israel, even though there's a complaint against it for committing genocide, has told Israel that they must release more food and humanitarian aid into Gaza. But Israel continues to thumb its nose against the international community, continues to thumb its nose against international law, and continues its destruction and death of Palestinian children in Gaza. We're going to be covering all those stories, Jamal, including the fact that Palestinian Christians are being barred on one of the holiest days in Christianity from the Old City for Easter. We're also going to talk about a very gruesome story about how Israeli soldiers executed two Palestinian civilians trying to return to northern Gaza while holding a white flag and then were buried by a bulldozer. A very gruesome story. We'll also talk about Biden's morally depraved move this week, Jamal, where they agreed to send more 2,000-pound bombs, F-25 planes, and more weapons to Israel during this genocide. And finally, we're going to talk about the Harvard Law School student government passing a resolution calling on the university to divest from Israel, the BDS movement. But before we get to that, Jamal, we're going to watch an interview that you did with Lara Kiswani. She's the executive director of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, otherwise known as AROC, and going to talk about why her organization and why other Arab and Muslim American organizations and individuals boycotted the San Francisco City Hall Iftar, stating that Mayor London Breed and several city officials have made racist, harmful, and dangerous comments about Palestinians, Muslims, and Arab American communities during the genocide, and took a stand to boycott this Iftar.
That's right, Jess. I mean, think about it. It's not just London Breed, but of course, on top of the list is President Biden. But this morning I saw a picture of a so-called Muslim leader posing after an iftar with the United Nations, U.S. United Nations representative after an iftar. I mean, this is someone who vetoes time and time again any resolution for ceasefire. And London Breed, not only did she condemn the Arab and Muslim community, did not call for a ceasefire, but then when the Board of Supervisors passed a resolution with a supermajority of 8-3, she wanted to veto it. She wanted to reverse it, but she was unable to do so because she didn't have the power to do it. Nevertheless, she basically did not support her constituency, the Palestinian Americans, Muslim Americans. And then there's an annual iftar hosted at City Hall. And she just basically wanted to continue business as usual and expect the Palestinian community and the Arab American community just to go there so she can have her photo up with them for her re-election campaign. But anyway, you can hear more details about this from Lara Kiswani. She is the executive director for AROC. This year, the Arab Resource Organizing Center, AROC, as well as other Arab and Muslim American organizations and individuals living in the San Francisco Bay Area, are boycotting the San Francisco City Hall Iftar, stating that Mayor London Breed and several city officials have made racist, harmful, and dangerous comments about Palestinians, Muslim and Arab American communities during the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza, where more than 32,000 Palestinians have been killed, and while Israel is deliberately starving 2.2 million Palestinians by denying the entry of food and other essential supplies. When the San Francisco Board of Supervisors passed a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza with a supermajority vote of 8-3, Mayor Breed attacked their decision. This is a rare action for a San Francisco mayor who claims to be progressive, yet criticizes a resolution promoting peace and advocating for the preservation of human life. Joining us on Arab Talk this week to talk about this and more is Lara Kiswani. She is the executive director of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, ARAC. Welcome again to Arab Talk, Lara.
Thank you so much, Jimmy.
Let me begin just to remind our audience by asking you about ARAC. What is ARAC and what is its mission?
ARAC is a San Francisco-based grassroots organization that provides direct services to poor and working-class Arabs and Muslims across Northern California and organizes our community to fight against the root causes of why they needed those services in the first place. And how we understand that is forced migration, racism, war, militarism. So we take part in various campaigns, local, national, and international, to try to build power in our community and understand the struggle for our people, the liberation of our people here to our homelands as part of the broader struggle for social justice and in connection to the freedom of all oppressed people.
So according to your press release, ARAC has participated in every Ramadan iftar hosted at San Francisco City Hall since 2019. What changed to bring you to the decision to boycott it this year?
You know, ARAC was part of this program since its inception in 2019 as part of the City Hall of Black Coalition with other grassroots partners in cities, community organizations and institutions. And we were really proud to start this initiative that was community-led to be able to provide, visibility for our community in the time of Ramadan. And it was historic in 2019 when we held the first City Hall of Ramadan iftar. At that time, we invited the mayor to speak. And in fact, we worked with our office and it was co-hosted by the mayor in City Hall. And that felt important for us as a community to be both recognized by the elected leaders, but in particular, the leader of San Francisco, the mayor, and to provide her a platform to speak directly to our people. Since then, as you named, the mayor has taken really harmful positions, but also voiced very dangerous rhetoric and language against our community. And so this year's planning process for the iftar differed greatly from previous years, where community partners were not brought in the same way. And concerns were raised about the mayor's involvement. And over time, it became clear that unfortunately, not only was the mayor of San Francisco, who has literally opposed our calls for ceasefire, essentially standing on the side of the genocide of our people in Gaza, but has actively taken a role to smear and attack our community. But they not only invited the mayor, they also invited all the board of supervisors who voted against the ceasefire resolution, which was a shameful act. So we had to make the very difficult decision based on feedback from our community and our base that we, in this moment, as has been seen in Houston and New York, we will not sit at a table and break bread with genocide supporters. But even worse than that, we will not give them a platform. So we did put out a call for a public boycott. That ARAC, we wanted to clarify to the community, to our movement partners and other allies, why we were making the decision to not participate and to boycott this.
How divisive have their remarks been in an atmosphere of racism and Islamophobia? Has your organization witnessed a spike in Islamophobic or anti-Arab and anti-Palestinian, spike in crimes, for example, or hate crime, basically?
Yeah, I mean, well, I could say that we've seen such a spike that we can't even account for it. We don't know how many students have been verbally attacked, how many are afraid to go to school, how many are being criminalized and treated as if they're doing something wrong by simply wanting to say through Palestine, wear a kufiya or a Palestinian pin in San Francisco public schools. We know that we've already seen the dangerous ways in which racist rhetoric actually results in violence, like we saw with Wadia in Chicago and we saw with the three men in Vermont. And these things are happening across the country, but also here in the Bay Area. People are losing their jobs. They are afraid to speak out. They are being targeted. They are being doxxed. And nothing is being done about it by our elected officials. And so we have asked time and time again for this to be addressed. In fact, we met with San Francisco Unified School District administrators and brought parents in a listening session for them to hear directly from the experience of parents and students about the climate of fear and Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian racism that we're feeling in San Francisco. And so the mayor, since October, hasn't uttered a word about this. She hasn't said one thing about a rise in Islamophobic attacks, hasn't said one thing about anti-Palestinian racism, hasn't voiced one sentiment to clarify that she, in fact, recognizes there's a genocide happening in Gaza, and instead has smeared us and attacked us and has made it out to be that those of us who support ceasefire are somehow seen as rogue, violent savages. I mean, some of the language used in her statement, which, by the way, was in response to a call from the mayor of Haifa. So the Israeli mayor of Haifa, an outside foreign government, called our mayor of San Francisco, wow, raised alarms about our ceasefire resolution. And our mayor, rather than heeding the calls from her constituents time and time again, asking her to identify, address the rise in Islamophobia, to call for ceasefire, responded to the mayor of a foreign government and put out a public statement smearing ceasefire supporters, and in particular, Arabs and Muslims in San Francisco.
So just let me reiterate, she has never reached out to the community. She has never reached out to your organization or her, any of her staff.
No. In fact, we, as a result of that racist statement that she went and put out publicly, the Council of American Islamic Relations, Jewish Voice for Peace, and AIRA sent her a letter, an open letter, sharing our concerns about the dangerous rhetoric in her statement, but also the very violent consequences that could result, and asked her for a meeting. And we never got a response. Earlier than that, with the rise of Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian racism and AIRA being attacked and called a terrorist organization by the Jewish Community Relations Council, the pro-Israel mouthpiece that has a regular working relationship with city officials, including the mayor, we also called on elected officials to meet with AIRA to hear our concerns and to defend our community and the people we represent when we are being called terrorists. And as you know, Jiman, being called a terrorist in this climate is what's justifying the genocide in Gaza. And again, nothing. We never heard from the mayor of San Francisco. So she has not met with us as community organizations. She has not met with community institutions. She has not met with those who've asked to meet with her, and instead has actually spoken at pro-Israel rallies, has been very visible in support of the ADLs and the JCRCs and their position against ceasefire.
You also talk about two of the supervisors, as well as the city attorney, also making racist and dangerous comments as well.
Yes. One of the first mass mobilizations that took place in San Francisco, I believe it was around 10,000 people that we helped organize. Most, I'm sure maybe you were there, and many of our community and allies were there in the street to voice our outrage at this genocide and demand an end to this violence and end to the war. There were youth and community and families that marched through the city of San Francisco. And right after that demonstration, District Attorney Brooke Jenkins posted on her Twitter calling our protesters, the community-led demonstration, Hamas supporters. So this is the type of people, these are the types of elected officials that we have to contend with in the city of San Francisco that were invited to the City Hall of Thought. And even worse, since then, District Attorney Jenkins has hunted down our community time and time again. Those who speak out, who engage in nonviolent civil disobedience, a tried and true tactic of every civil rights movement and social movement in this country, has literally hunted down allies, Palestinian and otherwise, including Jewish allies, and tried to, really criminalize them in ways that has not happened with other nonviolent civil disobedience actions. So we were appalled to see somebody who's literally called us Hamas supporters as a community, who's actively hunting down ceasefire activists, to also be invited. And then, as you named the other supervisors, Supervisor Dorsey Mandelman both were very vocal against the ceasefire resolution in City Hall and said, in the process of us mobilizing thousands, record number of people to City Hall for this incredible, momentous victory for our people here in the Bay and across the world to have San Francisco voting for, in a supermajority vote for ceasefire. In that process, as lovely and as community-driven as it was, we also had to endure these elected officials, hours and hours of testimony, our community sharing stories of losing family, of being attacked, being scared to go to school, being scared to be in society in general, our allies speaking out and showing up for hours and hours to speak for 1 minute. And then to have to listen to the rhetoric of Supervisor Dorsey, Supervisor Mandelman, and others who continuously smeared us, dehumanized us, you know, and invoked racist tropes against Arabs and Muslims. It was appalling. And so we had to endure that. And then to endure that and then allow them to be invited to a Ramadan iftar was something we just couldn't stay silent about.
I mean, you partook in the entire process of the resolution. And as you've mentioned, it passed with a supermajority 8-3. Is this normal for a resolution that passes the supermajority to be attacked by the mayor, you know, of San Francisco? And then I'm trying here to paraphrase. She claimed that neither the Board of Supervisors nor the resolution spoke for or on behalf of the entire city. I mean, is she tone deaf?
You know, I think the people spoke for themselves. Everybody was shocked to see thousands standing in line and wrapping around City Hall for 8 hours to speak for 1 minute, of which we can count on one hand how many spoke against the ceasefire resolution. The city stands for ceasefire, but more importantly, the San Francisco has proven time and time again, the people of San Francisco support Palestine and they support social justice issues. I don't know, to answer your question more directly, is it normal? I don't know. We've never seen the mayor do such a thing before. But I find some sense of hope in the fact that this was also the very first time we passed a resolution in San Francisco City Hall for Palestine. After all these years of organizing, community building in the city by our families and our allies around the question of Palestine, for us to pass this resolution, not just with a majority, but with a supermajority, which we didn't even realize we needed in order to avoid a veto. But fortunately, we moved the supervisors enough in the process where they all felt compelled to support this resolution. And so it was shocking. And I heard from many people that they were shocked that London Breed decided for some reason or another to actually go public against her own constituents in support of a foreign government. But I guess in some ways, it's no different than what we see with Joe Biden. You know, you have the president doing the same thing. Talk about being tone deaf when you have the majority of the Democratic Party, majority of all Americans calling for ceasefire, including his own, you know, congressional leaders and senators who are now voicing even, you know, Schumer speaking out for ceasefire. And you still have the president of the United States putting the foreign government, specifically that being the Zionist state of Israel, as a priority over his own constituents, and perhaps even handing this country over to Trump in order to maintain his alliance to the state of Israel.
Now, fast forward, the mayor and other city officials want to have an iftar at City Hall as though it's business as usual, so they can have their photo ops with members of the community. Of course, the mayor didn't show up after you put that press release out there. Was this a political stunt for her re-election campaign?
I mean, we can't separate anything this year from an election year. So we know that, politicians are inherently opportunistic and wanting to maintain their positions. And it is an election year. And it wouldn't be surprising to me if one of the motivations for her and other pro-genocide supporters is to say, to check off a box, here I am supporting the community. I am welcomed by the Arab and Muslim community. I am, supporting them, despite never having once uttered a word of actual support of our community or calling, speaking out against Islamophobia or speaking out against genocide. So absolutely, we felt we could not, in good faith, allow her a platform whether that be for political opportunism or any other reason, because what we, the community speaks for itself. We have made it clear what we want from our mayor. We want her to speak out against genocide and want her to acknowledge and recognize the harm she's caused through her racist statement, and to acknowledge the rise in Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian racism. Absent of that, showing up to a city hall with these performative gestures, we do not believe should be welcomed or encouraged. And so, of course, we believe that that perhaps was one of the motivations for
this. Might be a hard question, yet there are those who are from the community and who are willing to capitulate to the politicians through back channels, as I've heard, and undermine our community's solidarity. We saw that with the Biden administration handpicking individual Palestinians who really don't represent anyone except themselves and referring to them as leaders. Is there an element like this involved in what's happening, like with the Ramadan iftar, for example?
Unfortunately, I think this process did show that there's division in our community around how to engage in a meaningful and the very wide-based majority consensus call from our broader community across the country, which is we do not meet with, I acknowledge, work with, or normalize with genocide supporters. That has been a clear call across the United States. And not all Palestinians and not all members of the Muslim community have heeded that call, unfortunately. So I think this was a testament to that fissure in the community where there's still some who believe that there's another way forward, despite the majority of people, particularly leaders in the community, community organizations across the country, making it very clear that this is a red line for our community. It's a red line to meet with Joe Biden right now until he calls for ceasefire. It's a red line to allow them the opportunity to tokenize us without actually providing us with the material needs that we are requesting and demanding of them, which is to stop aiding in this genocide. And as you know, many in the community have met, not many, a select few have met with Lincoln, with President Biden. And so I think this process in the city hall of thought, unfortunately, perhaps brought to surface some of those contradictions. But the very fact that once we put out our boycott, it was met it was welcomed by many in the community, as you know, because it was a sentiment that was brewing for some time. And that's why we had to put out the statement. But also the planning committee decided, as a result, to actually disinvite all the elected. So we will.
So how harmful is it to go against the community wishes?
I think in this moment of unprecedented violence in Gaza and in Palestine, and the groundswell of solidarity that we have as a community across the world, and the international community clearly stands with Palestine and our people, that is more important now than ever that our community is united, that we are clear about our principles and our red lines. And it does not serve us to make ourselves smaller by trying to appease or appeal to those people who are aiding and abetting in our genocide. And for those who choose to do so, I think we need to ask the question, how does that benefit us as a community? How does that benefit our movement? How does it benefit the people of Gaza when we allow those who are continuing this genocide, who had the power to stop it today, to say that we met with the Palestinian community, we met with the Muslim community? That only allows them to give cover to their ongoing, the atrocities that they are making possible. So outside of self-interest, I think we need to pose the question of what else is gained from these types of meetings, from this type of normalization. And I think that question was put to the test in San Francisco, and ultimately everybody stood on the right side of history and said, okay, we cannot actually, in good faith, allow our community to be used and tokenized and make ourselves smaller and seem weaker by giving platforms to genocide supporters. And more than ever, it is time for us to show our power, to show our unity, as we did in Michigan with the uncommitted votes. We are demonstrating that our community is no longer disposable, cannot just be invisibilized and ignored, that we are a force to be reckoned with, that Palestine has become a wedge issue. And if now we decide to be more divisive and divide our community, then for the long term, for the sake of our dignity and humanity, both here and back home, for the sake of our people in our region, we are doing a disservice to them, especially here in the belly of the beast.
The Palestinian Arab and Muslim American communities have been part and parcel of the fiber of this diverse city for decades. Going forward, what would it take to mend this fissure that has been caused by the mayor and other city officials?
I think we are hopeful that moving forward, given that the mayor was disinvited and other genocide supporters were disinvited, we are very hopeful that the fissure is already being mended. We want to look forward and think about how we as a community can continue to advance advancing our rights, advancing our freedoms, advancing our community's needs here in the city of San Francisco, but also across the world, in terms of making sure that what we do here in San Francisco as a community, knowing that it sets the tone for much of the country, right? So for us to be clear that we are united, that we did not, like Houston or New York, we did not allow genocide supporters the platform to dine and the whole month of Ramadan with our community. We did something different in San Francisco. So I would say, for the sake of looking forward, we should be proud of what we accomplished and ensuring that this iftar did not move forward with the presence of genocide supporters. And there's work to be done for us as a community to be clear, to clarify, what are our objectives? What are our goals? What are our needs? How do we work collectively? How do we ensure that those most impacted by this war, those most impacted by the policies of the city of San Francisco, are at the forefront of the solutions, including having people speak for us who are not actually in touch with the people themselves that are facing the problem of all the policies that this city puts forth and ramifications of those policies.
Lara, thank you again for coming on Arab Talk.
Thank you so much.
That's the voice in the face of Lara Kiswani. She's the executive director for the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, AROC, talking about why AROC and other Arab and Muslim communities, organizations, and individuals boycotted the iftar at City Hall in San Francisco with London Breed. I have to say, Jamal, boycotting the iftar is the least that the communities can do to basically make a point and condemn London Breed's immoral stance, and I would say undemocratic stance, attempting to veto a resolution, as you said earlier, by a supermajority of supervisors. I mean, London Breed ran on a somewhat progressive platform to become mayor of San Francisco, stating that she wanted to represent all diverse communities in San Francisco. Yet, London Breed seems to be in the pocket, if you will, and being deeply influenced by the JCRC, condemning Jamal, a ceasefire resolution calling for the end of destruction and death to Palestinians in Gaza. It was outrageous. And, you know, London Breed is running for re-election. She's running against a number of individuals, maybe even Peskin, who's the president of the Board of Supervisors, but running against a number of individuals who may not be any more progressive than her. So I think San Francisco, Jamal, seems to be taking a very big turn to the right. It's very disappointing for London Breed, but I would say it's very disappointing to see the people who did go to the iftar in support of London Breed. Very disturbing.
Well, I mean, the thing is, Jess, is there was a long, hard-fought battle, a debate at the Board of Supervisors. People who stood in line for hours just to basically...
Just to say
what's on their mind for, you know, they were given a minute. They didn't stand for an hour to say, you know, we support a ceasefire, we should call for a ceasefire. So after the Board of Supervisors listen to all these people, their constituency, basically. London Breed didn't say anything until she got a letter from the mayor of Haifa, which she went, I think a year ago or so, to declare Haifa as a sister city. She got a letter from the mayor of Haifa, asking her to veto the resolution. I mean, this is a foreign country, or the mayor of a foreign country in a foreign city, asking her
to interfere.
Yes. And then she started making these statements. I mean, she would have been better off sitting on the sidelines. I mean, people were demonstrating in front of her office, in City Hall, Civic Center, downtown, the Embarcadero. Every day they've been demonstrating. She's been seeing, there are families in the San Francisco Bay Area who have lost members of their family, not one or two. Some of them lost 10 and 20 and 30 and 40 and 50. Entire families basically got exterminated in Gaza by Israel. So it's total insensitive on her behalf to criticize people who were just basically asking for the preservation of human lives. They're not asking send weapons to Palestinians to defend themselves. They're asking to stop the killing. And then she went against this. And just a quick note on the iftar, which basically was boycotted by the Palestinian American community and other communities. There were others who went, which I've heard, some from the Egyptian community and so forth. But the sad thing about it, there were organizers, some of them are Palestinians and others, who went through with this, even though there are many iftars in the Bay Area, just basically some of them are fundraising for Gaza, for the to bring clothes and food and so forth. And instead, they just want to go there for a photo op. And by the way, London Breed didn't show up. She didn't show up after that press release was, you know, she didn't show up.
Well, London Breed is not wanting to associate herself in pictures or in media of any kind with Arab, Muslim, Palestinian community. This is her re-election campaign, Jamal. We're seeing it. She vilifies this community. She denies the ability of these communities to exercise their democratic right to vote, to voice their opinion, to condemn the carnage and the genocide in Gaza. And then she wants to hold an iftar and doesn't want to show up. It's the height of hypocrisy. And, you know, Jamal, the same thing that we've been saying about, you know, the Democrats and the Biden administration can be said for London Breed, is that she's putting herself in a position to lose an election just by virtue of her inability to be on the right side of history and her immoral stance on the genocide in Gaza. So we're going to follow this, Jamal. This is not going away anytime soon.
Moving on to our next story, Jess, you know, Easter, Sunday Easter, and President Biden offered his congratulations and best wishes to Christians around the world. And I just should add, with an exception, except for Palestinian Christians, you know,
exactly,
who have been suffering under an Israeli occupation, doesn't say anything about that. In fact, Catholics, you know, in Palestine, as you know, people celebrate the Catholic Easter, which is this Sunday. And then in May, they'll be celebrating the Orthodox Easter. But nevertheless, the small Catholic, the dwindling, I should say, Catholic community in Gaza celebrated Easter with no electricity. No electricity.
No food.
No food. Starvation there. And Palestinian Christians who are living in the West Bank are barred from going to Jerusalem. Usually they have to submit an application for a permit. Imagine if you lived in Bethlehem, which is will take you less than 20 minutes to come into Jerusalem from Bethlehem, or in Ramallah or elsewhere. I mean, this is the holiest place for Christians, Jerusalem, to celebrate at the Sepulchre, the Church of the Sepulchre. They've been barred. And Jerusalem is basically a ghost town. The old city of Jerusalem, usually it's buzzing with not only Palestinian Christians, but also with tourists coming there. Shops, half the shops are closed. And not to mention that even before the war on Gaza, settlers have been attacking churches and Christians as they pass, spitting at them, harassing them, desecrating churches, desecrating cemeteries. So they're making life so uncomfortable for Palestinian Christians to drive them to immigrate outside the country. And as you know, this number has been dwindling and dwindling. I mean, soon,
For decades.
I have to say, Palestine might not have its indigenous Christians living there because of the occupation, because of the settler harassment.
But Jamal, isn't this the height of hypocrisy for Joe Biden and for the Christian community that he represents? Joe Biden is proud of his Catholicism. He's always proud of his faith. He touts that all the time in his press releases and his press conferences. He goes to church every Sunday. But here we have an extreme example of PEP, of the Palestine or the Palestinian exception, right? Here we have the holiest time for Christians, you know, which is Easter. Most Christians consider Easter among, if not the holiest, you know, time of the year. And you have Palestinian Christians who are being denied access and being denied the freedom to practice their faith. And what has Joe Biden, even the Pope said something, Jamal, even the Pope said something about this. But did Joe Biden, in his embracing of his own faith, say anything about it? The only thing we get from Joe Biden, Jamal, is more bombs, more weapons, more death, more support of the genocide. So we all have to ask ourselves, what kind of man of faith, what kind of individual is Joe Biden, who on the one hand can practice this faith called Christianity, and on the other hand, send more bombs to the apartheid state to kill more Palestinians, including Palestinian Christians? It's incredibly disturbing. We're going to talk more about this, obviously, but this one thing that you correctly highlight is the dwindling number of Palestinian Christians, not just in Jerusalem, where they've been forever, but in Bethlehem, the birthplace of Jesus, as well as throughout historic Palestine, the dwindling Christian population. It's a very disturbing picture.
Well, just adding to this, of course, Gaza, where Christians cannot leave even before October 7th. Do you know that there are Christians in Gaza that they've never been to the Holy Sepulchre? They've never been to Bethlehem, to the Nativity Church. Imagine you living your entire life as a Christian, and you are just basically an hour and a half away from the holiest place for Christianity. You cannot even leave there. There is an entire generation. You could be 30 years old living in Gaza, and you've never been to Jerusalem.
Unbelievable. Well, let's not forget, Jamal, the main church in Gaza was bombed by the Israelis, and dozens and dozens and dozens of Palestinian Christians were killed outside, around, and inside the church that was bombed. And we don't see any condemnation from Joe Biden. It's a very disturbing picture. We're going to continue to follow this story, Jamal.
And on the topic of Gaza, you know, it's another, like, almost like every day you see a new atrocity, and a new atrocity documented not only by eyewitnesses, but by film. You can see the crime being committed. There's a new video by Al Jazeera showing Israeli soldiers just shooting dead two Palestinian men in Gaza, with one of them waving a white flag, you know, and the two men were, as you've mentioned earlier, were buried in sand and rubbish by an Israeli army bulldozer, while one of an Israeli soldier, female soldier, was singing. I'm not making this up. This is on video. These poor men were trying to return to their homes in the north of Gaza via Al-Rashid Street, And they were like clearly waving the flag. They are unarmed. And then that shows it shows the Israeli soldiers basically shooting at them and killing them.
Not just murder. I mean, let's call it what it is. It's an extrajudicial assassination and murder of Palestinians consistent with international law, raising the white flag saying, you know, basically we come without weapons and we don't have anything, being murdered on video. And then the two things, Jamal, just to like bring the point home, buried in rubble by a bulldozer in garbage, buried in garbage, and then celebrated by an Israeli female soldier singing celebratory songs. This is part of a practice that we've been seeing with Israeli soldiers, Jamal, who have gone into homes in Gaza, have stolen money, have stolen jewelry, have desecrated Palestinian homes in Gaza, have destroyed any sense and erased any sense of connectedness to their homes. This is a level of depravity and international crime against humanity unlike anything we've seen in the modern era. And what's different, Jamal? This is not being done secretly. This is not being done under the cover of, oh, let's do this, but not show it because it would be too bad. They are proud of the inhumanity. They are proud about the crime against humanity that Israeli soldiers are committing. And this is part of an ongoing story, which I'm sure we're going to return to, Jamal, is all the video evidence that Israeli soldiers have been collecting in their war crimes. I mean, there's hundreds
of videos.
I always
said just that the Israelis are their best witnesses for their own atrocities.
War crimes.
Exactly. And war crimes. And they film themselves.
Keep all these videos coming.
And hopefully they'll be used at the ICC and the ICJ. But it's horrific anyway to see these videos. I mean, sometimes like you think that I'm sadly to say as if you're watching a movie, but it's not, it's reality. I mean, this is how ugly these videos are. And on the topic of Joe Biden, which you mentioned earlier, Jess, he recently and quietly authorized the transfer of billions of dollars worth of bombs and fighter jets to Israel. The new arms package include more than 1,800 MK-84. These are 2,000-pound bombs and 500 MK-82. These are 500-pound bombs, okay? 500, you think about it. You know what's a 500-pound bomb? What can a 500-pound bomb do?
Oh, I know. I know, Jamal. I've been in Gaza when those bombs have been dropped. I know what it feels like to be in that situation. These are devastating weapons of mass destruction. I mean, we think about weapons of mass destruction as being nuclear bombs, right? But a 2,000-pound bomb and a 500-pound bomb dropped on a densely populated area, it feels like the world is coming to an end. And so when the Biden administration makes all these noises about we want peace and Joe Biden is wringing his hands, he's so upset with Benjamin Netanyahu, it is unequivocal rubbish, Jamal. It's rubbish coming from the White House that they care about Palestinians and are putting pressure on the Israelis. You are in complete denial if you believe that, because when you send F-25s, you send more warplanes, you send more bombs, you send more military aid, the only thing that you can conclude is what? That you are supporting the genocide and the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. So, Jamal, the Biden administration and their campaign, they're doubling down on genocide. They're doubling down on genocide. They really believe that this campaign strategy and foreign policy is going to work. I don't know what you think, but I think we're headed for disaster.
Well, I mean, a picture is worth a thousand words, as they say, just so. When you watch on TV and see the Biden administration airdropping meals, ready-to-eat meals to Palestinians, parachuting those meals, and then at the same time, they're giving Israel to drop on Palestinians 500-pound bombs. I mean, this is the reality. This is the reality. And by the way, this is above and beyond the $3.8 billion that the United States gives Israel. Well, I should say the U.S. taxpayers gives Israel. It's above and beyond the $14 billion that have been recently authorized. This is kind of like an emergency transfer of additional bombs and weapons, which, by the way, several U.S. military experts have raised concern over this because it's depleting the U.S. stockpile.
That's right. The stockpile is already depleted because of Ukraine and now further depleted by the support of Israel. But I think, you know, we don't have time to talk about it today, but I think the political and moral and international law consequence of the United States continuing to do this, support a genocide, is going to come back in a strong way to haunt the Biden administration. They're, you know, Biden, former President Clinton, former President Obama had a big fundraiser in New York City this week, Jamal, and there were protesters condemning Biden for his policy. This in Palestine, his policy for supporting the genocide in Palestine. So this is going to follow him for a very, very long time. And, you know, well, obviously, this is going to be part of our analysis as we go forward. But I'm already anticipating that when the United States welcomes Donald Trump as president again, we'll only be able to thank Biden and his support for the apartheid state of Israel. We can thank them for bringing Donald Trump back to the White House.
And our final story just for the week is that the Harvard Law School student government,
yes,
has passed a resolution urging the university to completely divest from any organization that supports the Israeli war on Gaza. The measure urges the Harvard Management Company, HMC, which manages the school's $50 billion endowment, to divest completely from weapons manufacturers, firms, academic programs, corporations, and all other institutions that aid the ongoing occupation of Palestine and the genocide of Palestinians. The HLS student government alludes to Harvard's commitment of nearly $200 million in businesses linked to the Israeli occupation, military, and illegal settlements in Palestine, as well as the HMC's prior divestment from South African apartheid and the tobacco industry in 1990.
Yeah, I mean, this is really great for Harvard Law School. It's that they made this kind of principled analysis. And I will tell you, Jamal, since I'm being called nationally to engage in this discussion, one thing that is happening nationally in all the universities across the country is universities are getting ready to engage in BDS against Israel. Both boycott, divestment, and sanctioning from an economic standpoint, but also the academic and cultural boycott of Israel. So the Harvard Law School is just ahead of the curve right now, but we're going to see for the foreseeable future a very large, organized effort to boycott all academic engagements with the apartheid state. So, you know, this is, you know, something we know this. Benjamin Netanyahu dismissed the BDS movement as just a couple of, you know, a handful of people with no impact. But I'll tell you, Jamal, the BDS movement is the thing that the Israeli government fears more than anything else. They actually fear the BDS movement more than they fear any kind of resistance against the apartheid state. So we should be prepared for an uptick in the BDS activity.
Well, this is not the first resolution calling on other, of course, other universities pass similar resolutions.
Right.
And you know what bewilders me, Jess, is, okay, I don't understand why universities in general, just in general, why do they have to invest in Israel? I mean, this is just like a basic question. I mean, it's not the lack of investments within this country or other, you know, I don't know. I mean, there are all kinds of investments that people, Americans, invest their money, you know, whether in the stock exchange or in the bond market or whatever. Why do you have to go out of your way to invest in Israeli companies, and especially in Israeli companies that are linked to the Israeli military? I mean, that's just a basic, you know, I mean, for just the average person, why would they go and invest in an Israeli company?
Well, the question is, why would you invest in a country that is actively being pursued by the International Court of Justice for crimes against humanity and genocide?
And a country that has been declared an apartheid state by almost every single human rights organization.
Exactly. So the answer to your question is not a pleasant one. It's not going to be a good answer. But we may have to devote an entire show to the BDS movement to help our listeners and viewers understand how deep this kind of economic relationship between various universities and their investment units, because every university has one, and the apartheid state of Israel. They have very deep connections. We'll be exploring that in the future.
You've been listening to Arab Talk on KPOO San Francisco, 89.5 FM. Go to our website, arabtalkradio.com, to download the latest shows, and we'll speak to you next week.
We'll see you next week.